Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. I'm Ailey Packham and we are desperately trying to stay dry in association with allfootballshirts.com. Well, it was very much a five-star performance last Saturday as a decent Middlesbrough was swept aside and we progressed to the fourth round of the FA Cup. With eight Premier League sides knocked out in the third round and one more to come, we would have hoped for a bit of a kinder draw perhaps, but instead we'll face Liverpool or Wolves at the Amex at the end of the month. Speaking of Liverpool, they are our next opponents at the Amex and they've not gone home empty-handed since 1984. So, with the Albion scoring goals for fun, and Liverpool not currently putting up too many trees, is this perhaps our best opportunity for 39 years? Well, joining me to find out is, of course, Alan Wares, and we are delighted to welcome back the Argus's chief sports writer, Brian Owen, who's welcome back from the Anfield Wrap. Neil Atkinson, welcome back, guys. Lovely to see you all. And we've got cup fever, Neil. What about you?
No cup fever whatsoever. I wish I was feverish about the FA Cup, but instead it just made me ill, to be honest with you. Liverpool were dreadful and almost certainly should have, at the very least, found themselves 3-2 down, if not lost the game 3-2. You've got to accept the fact that the linesman put his flag up from a Wolverhampton Wanderers perspective. And now we go to Molineux. If we win at Molineux, it will mean we'll have had a run of fixtures, which reads something like Wolves, Brighton, Wolves, Chelsea, Brighton Wolves, which feels like some sort of cruel and unusual punishment, but we are where we are.
It's a bit of, it sounds like computer coding or something.
Thank you. Well, I did hear the word Chelsea in there, so you've got some easy points coming all the way for that.
And it's the home banker on my birthday.
Is it? Hang on, which of these dates is your birthday?
21st, Chelsea.
Well, a pre-happy birthday to you, mate. Brian, how are you, mate? What's occurring with you? I mean, have you been interviewing the entire Argentine squad?
No, just one of them.
In whose language, by the way?
Well, Alexis's English is brilliant, so it's all in English, but he did a really busy media day. I mean, you might have heard about it last week when he came back on Monday. You'll have seen the clips of him arriving, but he did a load of interviews and culminating in about six of us written journalists talking and firing some questions at him. So, very impressive.
Brian, were you in the building when the ticker tape went off?
No, I wasn't. No. I was in the building when reporters were trying to decide whether it was ticker tape or confetti. But I went with ticker tape because I can remember 1978.
Well, exactly. No, I mean, I'm really, really pleased, actually. I mean, this is kind of indicative of what Brighton and Hove Albion is. And actually, with a kind of a supporter of a Big Six side, where they've almost certainly had World Cup winners returning to their club. I mean, this is a complete and utter novelty for us to have this sort of thing happen. And I'm really pleased that, you know, because there were some sort of grumbles on social media, especially those sort of slightly older who are, you know, 40 years old and saying, you know, who remember 40 years ago, saying, hang on, what are we doing celebrating an Argentinian? But for me, this is just, you know, brilliant that the club just says, well, hang on, this is a world champion, you know, and he's there to be celebrated.
And it's never, ever happened. I mean, I was talking to someone about this a couple of days ago about that, you know, how far we've come from sitting with Dean in the pouring rain, losing to Rochdale, to having a world champion in our midst. It's just something else.
Absolutely. I mean, Neil, did you sort of get involved in the World Cup at all, or was it something you turned a blind eye to?
I mostly turned a blind eye, but I want to be clear, it was, you know, I wasn't at all happy with where it was. I didn't care when it was. I actually thought when it was a bit of an adventure. Where it was, like a lot of people, I wasn't at all happy with, but. But to be clear, that wasn't why I didn't watch much of it. Liverpool in the calendar year of 2022 played 60 games of football. I was very relieved that Liverpool were not playing football for a period of time, so I didn't watch much football. I sort of worked out in the end, I watched five of the knockout games. I watched some group games when they were just on in the house, but I only watched any of five of the knockout games in the end, and loved the final, had a really good time watching it. So, you know, it wasn't some sort of grandiose statement, and I wouldn't want to be misconstrued, but for me, it just sort of became a good opportunity to do other things with life and time, other than association football for a couple of weeks.
Yeah. But you did have an interest in the final as well with Konate playing. So, you know, it was I now feel like I know personally how it feels to win a World Cup, having
watched. How can you feel that?
Because England are never going to do it, and I was kicking every ball. I was Team Argentina all the way, and I absolutely loved it.
Just I think it's, by the way, I think that the sort of the return stuff's great. I think it looked brilliant from the outside, and I think it shows, like, surely part of this is being able to sort of make friends with other nations and other cultures and all of that. That's literally part of football. It's one of the reasons why I hope Brighton get into Europe this year, because I think it's deserved, but also I think more clubs should get the opportunity of European football in general. Yeah. And so part of that is, you know, we get these sorts of things. I think it was great. I loved all the fuss and the sort of the pomp that was around it. Let it be. Show that fuss, show that pomp, celebrate the lads, yeah. Make them happy.
Well, Neil, we're already practically French.
Exactly.
It's a good thing. So, okay, so obviously this weekend sees Liverpool come to the Amex. You've had a pretty good record at the new stadium, not so good at the old one. But, you know, last time you haven't, like, gone home empty-handed since 1984. It's a game which we all remember. It was one of the rare games that was actually back on TV back in the day as well.
Well, to be fair, that was the FA Cup. So, yeah. Neil, we do a lot of stuff together, you and I. You know, you kind of invite me onto your podcast, The Anfield Wrap, which is, well, just hugely bigger than anything that we do. But you know, you do get away fans' perspectives on there. And you've been actually quite vociferous in your praise of what the Albion are doing, both on and off the pitch. So when it comes to, given the fact that the Liverpool's record at the Amex is actually pretty decent, how are you personally, given your love for Liverpool Football Club, looking towards, you know, looking forward to this game on Saturday?
I am looking forward to it because, first and foremost, I think it'll be a really good game of football. I thought the one at Anfield this season was a good game of football, and both games last season were good games. I think there's an interesting conundrum for Albion, first and foremost, which is how rubbish do they think Liverpool are at the moment? And how much should they go for the throat in the game from the outset, or pick their moments? Because this is it's a Liverpool side that is vulnerable, and vulnerable in certain phases of the pitch. But the flip side of that is I feel as though this Liverpool side could well be suited by having a few weeks of coming up against sides who fancy it a little bit, and give Liverpool the opportunity to maybe play a teeny little bit on the break. So I think there's questions for both teams going into it ultimately, which is where do they think, what level do they think they're punching at, and so on and so forth. So I'm intrigued to see how it plays out.
Yeah. Brian, I mean, under the Zerbi, I mean, we certainly tend to go for the jugular anyway, don't we?
Yeah, I think it'd be really nice to have something special for the home crowd again, because there's been so much amazing stuff away from home. And obviously there was Chelsea at home since then, and the culmination of the Arsenal game, but not the first half. Yeah, I'll be interested to see how it pans out. My first game actually at Brighton was against Liverpool in 1983, Brighton 2-0 up and cruising, Gary Howlett, and they ended up not winning that. Ian Rush scored twice.
At the 3-3?
No, 2-2. It was 2-0, Brighton dominating, and then Ian Rush scored, and you knew that when Ian Rush scored, Liverpool didn't lose.
True. I do remember that. So, obviously, Neil, your side's coming down here, and I think the big talisman, the one that everyone fears, certainly that, you know, the likes of Glenn Murray is called the best defender he's played against. Virgil van Dijk is not playing. Now, are we going to read too much into to his absence?
Quite possibly, yeah. Listen, Konate and Matip were not quite what we want them to be against Wolves, but I think they'll come on for the game and for playing together. And I think Konate is really exciting as a centre-back prospect. So, you know, obviously not having Virgil will be a problem, but then there's a wider point, which is that I actually don't think Virgil's had his best Liverpool season. I quietly don't think he was as good for the first half of this season as he was for the second half of last season. And I sort of struggle to work out precisely what to put that down to. And it may well simply be that he's been worked harder because Liverpool have been more porous over the course of the first half of this season than they were the second half of last. But I don't feel as though, you know, in the past, I'd have felt like the missing of Virgil would have felt enormous. As it is, I think it's obviously a blow. You want to have every player available, and you say they want to play with that quality available, but it's not quite what that was.
So in that case, Neil, do you think part of that is actually that Virgil needs a bit more quality to help him around him?
I think the around him part's difficult. I think that there's a number of things that have sort of happened for Liverpool this season, but one of the things that I feel as though sides have been able to do is exploit gaps between Liverpool midfield and attack and Liverpool between defence and midfield. And that just means more football's happened in and around Virgil. I think there's been... I noticed it intriguingly at Villa Park. We play well at Villa, by the way. We go there on Boxing Day, we win 3-1. It's a good performance. Much the better side first half. But second half, what was interesting was Unai Emery, who I think we can all agree is a clever man, placed John McGinn between Thiago, Andy Robertson and Virgil van Dijk. And just had him cheat the other side of Thiago. And I think his attitude was he wanted to make Thiago turn round or pull Virgil out or pull Robertson out of shape. And Leon Bailey played in the space that Robertson had vacated in that second half. The first half, they tried to play McGinn just as a wide right, playing in the space that Robertson had vacated. My point here is that often when we talked about Liverpool and where they get got at by opposition sides, we talk about Trent Alexander-Arnold and whatever centre-half it is on that side and playing in that space. Whereas I think there's been more and more of sides deciding to play in the space behind Thiago and in front of Virgil over the course of this season. And then in general, you know, I think Liverpool's midfield has not functioned particularly well over the course of the campaign. I think there's reasons for that, which are just beyond even their age. I don't think the age helps, but I think I said before about 60 games Liverpool play in the calendar year 2022. You know, last season, not only do Liverpool go all the way in everything, but for instance, Jordan Henderson makes the most appearances for Liverpool over the course of the enormously long season. And I think it's not just the idea of, oh, these lads are all a little bit older. I think Liverpool put a hell of a lot into the second half of last season. They won two cups, so don't get me wrong. They got to a Champions League final and they took the league title to the last minute. But I think that that's maybe had a little bit more of a toll. And then there wasn't any form of a refresh in midfield in the summer. And I think that there's also something psychological about that as well. I think Liverpool all season looked like a side in need of a spark. And every now and again, a spark comes in a game and the spark's there and they look right. And then the next game you see them, the next time you see them, it just doesn't look like it's quite there. And I think that the way last season ended, physical, mental, I think it's all taken a bit of a toll. And the area where it's taken the most toll is midfield. And the area where Liverpool have refreshed least in the last 4 or 5 seasons is midfield.
So given that, and I mean, this is something we then sort of wanted to go on to anyway. Now, we always try and avoid this on the Albion Roar. We like to go with facts and stories and things that happen rather than gossip and rumour and infuriation of citizen journalists every time the transfer windows open. But so obviously, as a Liverpool fan, you're casting your eye out as to who might be, you know, a possible replacement. And once and again, once upon a time, we've talked about Yves Bissouma going to Liverpool. He could have done a job. I think moving to Spurs has not started well for him. And then comes, you know, his co-hi, his protege, Moises Caicedo, 25 games into his Premier League career, and he's being touted to just about everyone. One, what's your take on him? And two, what's your take on the ongoing, for us, tedious speculation around Liverpool signing just about everyone?
I find it tedious as well. And I think that one of the questions and issues that Liverpool have got is we've been linked to just about every type of midfielder. And that concerns me if there's veracity in that, because Liverpool have still... One of the questions, Liverpool were doing more of a remoulding of their midfield last season than they were given credit for. I think Liverpool planned for last season to be quite transitional and then all of a sudden found themselves waking up at a situation first week of February where they could win all four trophies and decided to commit everything to that. But I think in Liverpool's mind's eye, last season was a season to consolidate in top four, maybe have a run in Europe and just sort of get out, having made a few changes and moved along. And it became something else. And Liverpool did the right thing to try to pursue, because how many opportunities in life do you get to try to win all four trophies? Mm, did the right thing. But what this means is I think Liverpool have had a sense that the forthcoming summer will be a massive summer of rebuild, especially in the middle of the park. And I think they've got the idea of Jude Bellingham as the linchpin of that. But I think that what a lot of that's led to is that Liverpool actually aren't making a ton of decisions about what sort of midfield they actually want to have. Do they want to have a midfield like Manchester City that's very, very good at controlling space, at controlling the ball, at limiting opportunities, and has a creative spark in there from the middle of the park? Or do they want a midfield like the one that brought Jurgen Klopp to the party, which, whilst it wouldn't be right to describe it as uncreative, was an absolute pressure cooker of a midfield that would absolutely smother sides. And where Liverpool have ended up this season is a midfield that doesn't create anywhere near enough and is simultaneously unable to put pressure on anybody. So what worries me about the breadth of the links is, well, what is it that we actually want? And it can't just be really good players because, you know, Caicedo, as you say, is a really good player. But it can't just be we want really good players because that's not a strategy. There's loads of really good players out there. It's instead what sort of football team do we want to be, and not just for the rest of the season, but for the next sort of two or three. And Liverpool under Klopp, there's always been a really strong sense of what it is we want to be and why we want to be that team. And I feel that for the first time, really, that's ebbed away a tiny little bit. And that throws us open to the sort of the poor performances that we throw in, but it also throws us open to being linked with practically everyone under the sun.
Yeah. Do you think that there's a danger though, Neil? I mean, obviously this season you haven't necessarily been putting up too many trees, as I said in the intro, and there is a danger that you might not necessarily qualify for the Champions League this year unless you win it. And with the added caveat with the clubs currently up for sale as well, is there a case that you might actually panic buy in this January?
I don't quite see a panic buy. I think there's a chance Liverpool overpay for a footballer. And that's where, for instance, conversations around Caicedo could come in. That Liverpool find themselves in a situation where the sort of player, not necessarily the actual player, but the sort of player profile that Liverpool might be able to pursue for 35 million in the summer, they might end up paying 64 now. And that isn't good, obviously, but it's not quite the same as panic buying. I don't think Klopp has got any interest in buying a footballer that he can't see him using at the club in 3 or 4 years' time in this January window. I think if Liverpool were to have panic bought a midfielder as well, they may well have already done it by now. And I think that part of what leads to some supporter frustrations is that I think Liverpool remain determined to pursue the idea of ensuring they're getting the most possible value for money out of every single signing. And they won't rush into something. There's something else as well, which is that the actual, with the exception of the Wolves replay, don't get me wrong, but the number of fixtures actually dissipates a little bit. We've gone out to the EFL Cup. We'll see what happens after the Wolves replay. But we're quite close to one game a week, other than that Wolves replay, for a period of time, which gives more time for the players to rest and recharge. Now, trust me, if they rest and recharge and put in the sort of lacklustre second gear performance they threw in against Wolverhampton Wanderers and Brentford, then we're in a lot of trouble. And that's the concern at the minute, is that they might not be able to get out of that second gear, a couple of these lads. But that's for the manager to solve, first and foremost. He's got games of football to play and he's got to crack on and solve them. And it starts on Saturday at the Amex.
Yeah, I think that's what we're concerned about, Brian, is the fact that Liverpool might find that gear shift.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it's almost like don't underestimate Liverpool, isn't it? But like I say, we had the Chelsea game with at home, and there was the culmination of the Arsenal game, which could have been so dramatic without that strange offside, but technically was offside, obviously.
Don't trigger him. For Christ's sake, Brian, don't trigger him.
It's all right. He keeps freezing anyway. But they've played so well, haven't they, Brighton, away from home, and just to bring that back and, see a big crowd, hopefully enthusiastic, 3 p.m. Saturday. And a few selection. I mean, you're talking there about centre backs for Liverpool. Who will they be up against? Who will they be trying to? Who will be leading the Brighton attack? Welbeck, Ferguson, Brossard. Did Brighton bring Trossard back? Perhaps we'll talk about him later. But that area, sort of wide, sort of inside leftish, that Brighton got so much success earlier at Anfield. Does Mitoma do well in that area? So I think it's a good. You know, it feels like everybody's on. There's a lot of players on form, and it's coming. You can be upbeat about this, the prospects.
Yeah, Neil, when you look back to what our last league game was, which I know you took particular delight in, us winning 4-1 at Everton, it's an interesting conundrum. I mean, like, Ferguson's come in and he's like setting the world on fire for us, and he's been absolutely stunning. I mean, it was a player that you tried to sign, and we actually got our noses ahead of you.
Yeah, I remember. I saw that link the other day that had happened in there as well. And you know, I think that there's another. I think Caicedo himself could actually be in there. But that's back to whether or not Liverpool are prepared to pull the trigger. And also, to be fair to the footballers in this instance, whether or not they feel as though there's a smooth enough pathway where they'll get regular games. I think he looks like a really, really strong player. Looks like a really good prospect. I think that ultimately Pascal Gross's goal should win every award going come the end of the season. It was a masterpiece. I would hang it in the Louvre. That's how much I loved every single aspect of it. It was It was a really.
Is that because you're sort of currying favour with us, or because you're just going, you're sort of blowing raspberries at the toffees?
That's absolutely about the toffees. I love the number of toffees who, for instance, were furious with the concept of a sporting director post match, whilst lamenting the fact that Brighton's combined score has cost £5 million. there was much to enjoy around that from an Everton point of view, because I think that there's some results that bring home the depth of a crisis that a football club is actually in. And they don't happen quite like we won 4-1 at Goodison last year. And whilst there was like a they were staring into the abyss in terms of the amount of quality difference. Well, we're Liverpool. I think the idea that, you know, the amount of, and now Brighton have done this to us, as though in some way, shape or form, before a ball was kicked this season, Everton were going to finish within 15 points of Brighton, was part of what I think, and the realisation that it was never thus is part of what I think has really sort of captured the attention now at Goodison, and there's an unbelievable amount of pressure on their hierarchy off the back of it, because ultimately Brighton are what a well-run football club looks like, and Everton are the absolute opposite of that, and that fourth goal just beautifully sums up that moment and that difference.
I mean, again, you know, with the Anfield Wrap, you have your away supporters on to offer their opinions, and it's great that you offer that airspace to us, and wonderful. So, and I know that you've been watching the Albion certainly since before we got into the Premier League. So, even given the sort of the nonsense that we had in September with Chelsea deciding to try and rip basically not just the heart, but I think most of the liver, kidneys, and some of the bowels out of the club. Are you surprised to see Brighton where they are now?
No, because I think first and foremost, a club's about a culture that gets set from somewhere. And Brighton's was clearly beyond the managers. The manager was a massive part of it, and any manager will be a significant part of it. But it feels to me as though Brighton's always sort of transcended that. And the core thing that Brighton have nailed and worked out, I think, is ultimately, and it won't last forever because nothing does in football, but understanding risk within recruitment and being able to leverage that risk to Brighton's advantage. And then within that, deciding to find a way to get the best possible coaching that they can in any given moment to bring that out and to select really, really wisely. I, for instance, have loved watching Matoma this season. I think he's a phenomenal footballer. And I think it speaks volumes for Brighton that they were the side who were prepared to take a gamble on him, and then also slowly but surely bring that to fruition. Not as though it's the finished article, but in a way, no. Which is, we know that there's some development that this footballer needs, but we're prepared to do that. And I think on and off the pitch, you know, for me, De Zerbi feels like the next sensible move now. Not necessarily, you know, I liked him, you know, his CV, don't get me wrong, but I wouldn't have said this is bound to work. But it feels like the next sensible move now off the basis of the thing that sort of had to happen next was to keep everyone on board. It's interesting listening to Brian talk about the home sides. The home support could do with a big one. And I get that, because that's a massive part of why we go to football. But seeing, for instance, you know, 9 goals in the last 2 games, whether supporters are in attendance of those games or not, is a real fillip. It's a real boost, because that's what makes football crowds go, we are moving in the right direction, we are moving all together. And I think that's the proof currently of where Brighton are. And I'll say again, listen, I genuinely am of the view that had European football, had there been a proper strategy around European football in this country and ensuring it's passed around more fairly over a longer period of time, I think there's a chance that this country doesn't vote to leave the European Union. I think sides like Brighton having the opportunity, I think it'd be terrible if you sell Caicedo, by the way. I really don't want you to, even if it's us who are buying him. And the reason why is because I think that it would be a real moment for Brighton as a football club. I was very much in favour of Benfica keeping Enzo Fernandez. Enzo Fernandez could be part of a Benfica side that wins the European Cup this season. They're 8 points clear at the top, the Premier League. Caicedo could be part of getting a Brighton side to get European football at the Amex. And that's sort of the point. Like, Caicedo's got 10 years of career. Like, let him go in the summer, by all means. But he's got 10 years of career after this. But he's on an adventure here with this group of footballers. And you were all on the adventure with that group of footballers. And yeah. I've been on an adventure, a great one, with our group of footballers. And maybe that's going to crash upon the rocks for a brief period, but we'll start a new adventure and it'll all be great. I don't like it when footballers or anyone really decides to leave that adventure. I didn't like what Potter did, but Brighton have gone on. And I think that this will be a great moment for Brighton and Hove Albion to qualify for Europe, whether that's through winning the FA Cup or whether or not that's through league position. I think that's... Like, it feels like that's what should come to pass over the course of this campaign. And I think that being feeling it in and of itself, whether it is a trophy or like a trophy, I think is massive. And then from there, not necessarily building, and that's the bit we always get wrong. Like, there's loads of Liverpool supporters who are frustrated that the club haven't invested well enough, which I've got a lot of sympathy for. But then this thing that's added where they say, because Klopp could have built a dynasty. And Manchester City have got all the money in the world and the best coach in the world and a great recruitment policy, and they haven't built a dynasty. They've won a lot of league titles, but they haven't been able to win a European Cup. What matters is enjoying the journey and staying in the journey and staying in the moment, and the footballers themselves doing that's really important as well. That's what Brighton do. And so if it comes together, European football next season, but guess what? You just finish 11th, you get to the quarterfinals, whatever that European competition is. It doesn't mean it was all a waste of time. It means it was all brilliant. And you're watching a great side play great stuff, and that's all we can ask for.
And of course, Neil, there is the cautionary tale that the grass isn't necessarily greener for the likes of Caicedo if they are looking up sticks. I mean, we're seeing Bissouna struggling at Spurs. We're seeing Cucurella not like pulling up any trees at Chelsea. It's you know, at Brighton, they're part of something. They're part of a team. We haven't really got any real superstars. We're some of our parts, really.
Yeah, but I think on that though, like, they don't all feel like opportunistic signings, and they're bad ones. I mean, they're not always bad ones. Sometimes it works, but they can be bad ones on the whole. And, you know, if it's not clear where player X was meant to fit or where player X fits, like the Bissouma Tottenham thing to me just seems all a little bit odd in that he's just another one of something else that they've got. And he was never going to be sort of allowed to be centred, not least because Højbjerg, I think, is an underrated footballer, but he's obviously a really important character around that Tottenham side. So, you know, I think players should consider all of these factors, I think, before they move. And not just sort of commit to the first thing. I think that the smart Caicedo thing really is for him, for Brighton, even to in a really weird way, whilst Liverpool could do with a player like him, even for the club who was signing him, it would be better for everyone, I think, if there was ways to hang on until the summer. Now, don't get me wrong, if we sign him and he does well and Liverpool end up finishing fourth, then you're vindicated in that sort of decision. But I think that part of how Brighton are a club that should be watched is because when Brighton invest in a footballer, they've got a plan around that footballer. Part of, if you look at Liverpool, Liverpool's recruitment, the issue around Liverpool's recruitment isn't whether or not it's been successful, it's whether or not there's been enough of it. When Liverpool buy a player, there tends to be a really clear plan for that player, where he's going to play, why he's going to play there, what we want from him, and so forth. They're the best bits of recruitment. What Chelsea have done and are doing is frankly ridiculous and ludicrous, and it's as damaging to football as anything else, and it makes no sense to me at all. I think, and it's long-term damaging to Chelsea because they haven't got an oligarch anymore, and they're not backed by a state, and at some sort of point, there's got to be return on investment in around all of this, and Chelsea have ended up acting in a way that I think is just downright irrational. If there's a problem with Liverpool and Liverpool's ownership, the argument is that they act far too rationally. At times, there's got to be a bit of a middle ground, perhaps sometimes when football clubs need it, but this is where we find ourselves.
I mean, that would be that famous 4-4-3 formation that Chelsea want to. Thanks to Neil for joining us, but you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. The show, as ever, is brought to you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com. And Phil has sent us an absolute doozy this week. I'm loving this one. Brian, what are you thinking?
Yeah, it's quite unusual, isn't it? Do you want me to describe? it?
Yes, please.
Yeah, so it's black with a yellow, what looks like a bat emblem. It's sponsored by Airlight, and there's another sponsorship or something there, which is like the yellow, what's that, black sort of emblem, looks like a house with a chimney, but I'm not quite sure that's what it's supposed to be. Messler and other sponsorships, Coca-Cola and another one. There's a lot of emblems on it, and the badge is almost like a sort of a Mexican type flag, but it's essentially a yellow bat on a black background. But it's not the bat like you see on a Valencia shirt.
No, it's Phil with his sense of, I don't know, safety and schadenfreude, because he loves seeing you trip over Spanish words, Adrian. I've actually made a point of looking out to see who this is. It's another Mexican club, isn't it?
It is a Mexican club.
It's an ex-Mexican club called Murcielagos.
Which is bat.
There you go.
There you go, indeed. Okay, and this is what Phil has to say about this particular jersey. It says, your shirt of the week, then, chosen well because It has a bat on it. And why not? This is the 2015 to 2016 home shirt of Murcia Argos Football Club, who play in Mexican La Liga Premier, which is the third tier of football in Mexico. The side was founded in 2008 in the city of Juamercio in the state of Sinaloa on the northwest coast of Mexico. The club's nickname is The Bat and Los Caballeros de la Noche, the Dark Knights, apparently. I have no idea why. And home is the 11,134 capacity Estadio Centenario Los Mochis. And in 2010, the side made history of sorts by becoming the first club in the world to allow its fans to vote through the web on the starting lineup in games. And this was actually supported by FIFA. In the first game under the system, they won 1-0. And they've even used the facility to vote in real time on substitutions during games and also to choose the training regimes. There's a head coach, but choices for selection are at the behest of the online fans. And in 2012 season, the team went unbeaten in the regular season and the playoffs. And who'd have thought that a keyboard and armchair managers knew what they were talking about? Sadly, after the COVID-19 pandemic in 2020, the club went into hiatus due to the ensuing economic crisis and have yet to recommence playing. He's failed to find any links to the UK, but midfielder and Pablo Caballero played 26 times for Liverpool. But this was the Liverpool in Montevideo, Uruguay. And he also found a markedly interesting name associated with Murcia Argos. In 2013, Costa Rican centre-forward Henry Cooper made a handful of appearances whilst on loan from Limon. Thank you very much for that, Phil. And of course, you can see this and over 130,000 others over on oldfootballshirts.com.
Brian, how was his pronunciation?
Couldn't tell what. Well, I think he started to say "notche" at one point, which sounded like when he said about the whatever it was.
It was "notche," yeah.
For the night, Murcia Argos. I don't know. Have you seen that? I went to Mexico for quite a long time ago, and their league it was then vibrant, big crowds, enthusiastic, flair, football, and kits. I went to Cruz Azul one game, which is like literally a blue, almost like a bullfighting ring, their stadium, and America at the Azteca. Really, really entertaining league, but not one that people sort of follow that much. But hadn't heard of that club, I must admit.
It's probably one of the highest quality leagues in certainly north of the equator, yeah. Especially given Mexico's history in world football. But yeah, it's I can't help feeling it's probably a bit like going to every match you're going into in Mexico is a bit like going to one in Serbia or in Buenos Aires. It's all a bit hectic and a bit mad.
The best place, again, it was a long time ago, to get sort of cheap street food, you know, rather than the touristy places outside a football ground, was absolutely some brilliant stuff there. And just before we move from Mexico to Middlesbrough, I guess, I don't know if you've seen that Netflix series, Club de Cuervos, which is the Club of the Crows, which is a comedy thing about how a football club is run. And I suspect it's a parody on things that really happen. So they do things like kicking off at 7 a.m. to get the TV audience and taking the club to somewhere else. But then to somewhere else. So it's Club of Cuervos of this town, of this town, of this town. And there's a lot of strange kits and a bloke who takes over and knows nothing about football and all sorts of really funny things. So look out for that on. It's on Netflix.
Sure, that's not called Chelsea.
Or well, sort of like a really good idea of getting the fans to decide the substitutions. I mean, that's backfire, is it?
That's more like to be Crawley.
Absolutely true. But talking about street food there, Brian. Obviously, did you have the local delicacy at the weekend? And the Palmo?
Yeah, well, I thought I'd overdone it a bit because I did get a full size Palmo in a back street in Middlesbrough, but I did end up finishing in a traffic jam on the M1, so it was coming back on Sunday, so it was a wise investment. They're formidable things, and they don't look that formidable when you open them. But
what is is it that fills you up then?
It's the chicken.
No, it must be the Betcham. No, it's not the chicken because they hide how little chicken there is. The one I went to by the amount of is it bechamel sauce and cheese. So right. I think it's that. They also give you a container of chips and a token container of salad. So you literally get a shopping bag tied up at the top.
Wow.
Your Palmo. It's not like you take out a little thing like a portion of chips or something. It actually comes in a shopping bag tied up at the top. So yes, I did in a back street in Middlesbrough, where when I googled it, I saw the 3-bedroom terrace houses were going for $40,000.
Oh, don't get started on houses in the North East.
A Palmo is a sort of thing, though, Brian, where you get a cheese hangover, isn't it? It's just your head just hurts off.
I've never had one, but is it a case it's wrapped in a really sort of doughy bread or something?
No, it's breadcrumbs.
No. Is it literally just chicken and cheese?
If I've got this right, you can have anything as the base, but I think the main one is the classic is a chicken. It's like a chicken parmesan, if you like, but a bit cheaper version, I guess. Anyway, I was glad I still had a little bit left over, which I finished cold in the traffic.
Back in the early days of the Amex, when we were trying to entertain all of our visitors with, and it's still a shame that the away beer thing doesn't happen anymore, but and the whole sort of concourse lit up in the appropriate colours. It's a pity. I mean, that was an idea. I think it certainly still has legs. But Middlesbrough came down in one of the early years and the caterers had a go at making a Palmo. Now, it wasn't anything like what they had, but they were genuinely, genuinely appreciative of the fact that we gave it a go.
Should we move back to football?
Yeah, go on then.
Yeah. I was going to say, okay, well, we went into this game, Brian, and Roberto De Zerbi was angry. He was upset. The Charlton defeat was still looming large in his head. And it was a certain way to exercise those demons, wasn't it?
Well, he didn't, because he's still angry. He said afterwards that he was angry about the Charlton game and upset, so it hadn't eased anything. But it was, and it was a way of learning that lesson in that they had more of a killer instinct. Initially, I sort of feared, are they going to pass and pass and play attractive football and the final pass breaks down? But it didn't. Obviously, they ran away with it. They showed a ruthless edge. I mean, we're talking about all these goals, but all of these away games, you come in away thinking they could have had one or two more. But I know the locals hugely impressed by what they saw, talking about the people in the media room. They're talking about a ripple of applause. I'm sure there was when there was that fourth goal went in, the one where they cut through and more or less walked the ball in the net. I wanted to say earlier as well, I think there was some applause when McAllister's name was read out when he came on at the... Unless it was coincidence and they were clapping somebody come off, something was happening in Middlesbrough, I'm not sure, but it was definitely a few little applause when his name was read out, because obviously the sub goes on after everybody else. So I hope I didn't misinterpret that, but that seemed to be the case. But everybody, it was striking how many nice things were being said about Brighton.
I was going to say, I mean, reading through social media after the game, the amount of comments coming from Borough fans. I mean, you know, bearing in mind we're often trolling through it to try and find the teams like Brighton comments. There were none, and they're all fully appreciative, and they actually saw us as a yardstick for what they could possibly achieve themselves.
Well, I think what's one thing that's happened is let's rewind to that particular day in May 2016. When Borough got their promotion, and that sort of kind of hateful day. I mean, I look back on it, and I thought it at the time, to be honest, but I certainly do look back on it now as a kind of a bullet that we dodged, not going up that particular season. You know, given that we had been relegation fodder the previous season, it was Houghton's first full season in charge. We'd had a wonderful season. You know, I think it was the first 23 games, was it? Something like that, until Borough turned us over at the Amex. And, you know, the whole sort of pantomime over Dale Stevens and the Spanish fella, Gastron Ramirez. And all that sort of nonsense. And Mike Dean being centre of attention. You know, I think genuinely fired people up. You've seen it in the Albion videos that they've put out there about how the season started the next day. And it was a bitter pill for us to swallow. But if you look at the divergent paths that both clubs have gone on, Middlesbrough came straight back down and haven't looked like promotion candidates really since. And then you've got the Albion going from strength to strength, albeit slowly going through the gears. And it's those 6 years, 5 or 6 years, that have actually made that difference, that we've gone up incrementally, they've gone down incrementally, to the point that the gap is now pretty big. And I think it was an indicative thing of that. And if ever there's one of these things that, you know, we demand satisfaction, we demand recompense, then beating them 5-1, I think, does that quite amply. Mm. If you were minded to think that actually we deserve to get some kind of revenge on them.
But Brian, this is a Middlesbrough team that under Michael Carrick are certainly improving, and they're pushing the playoffs. I mean, they're the form team in the division, so to go there and to win 5-1 is magnificent.
And they made one change to the team that won at Birmingham in their previous league game. And a lot of the talk before, I was talking to a couple of, I think I was the only Sussex reporter who made it up there for that game, and so it was, I was surrounded by the North Easterners, and they're all really friendly and what have you. So. And they were saying this is going to be too close. Don't know which way this is going to go. It's going to be too close to call, sort of thing. I mean, Al talking about that was 2016. When you look at those teams now, what happened to Sheffield Wednesday, where they are now, who beat Brighton in the playoffs? I think Hull went up.
Burnley.
Burnley are not doing so bad now. So I think Derby were in the playoffs. And look what. So they've all faded away. Burnley, probably the best of the others now. But I did sort of have memories of that Saturday, although we've been back since in the FA Cup. I did sort of have memories of that Saturday lunchtime when I was up there and, you know, seeing the same sort of places but different environments and how far they've come. It's quite a good time to go in a way, just as a reminder, just as we've been embarking on this, really on this sort of brave new chapter.
Yeah. And it's exciting times. I mean, you know, when you score, you know, 3, 4, 5 away from home, as we have in the past few weeks, and to be honest, away from home certainly don't look like letting up. I think Charlton is the aberration. They all look ring rusty that particular night. The loss of them. I mean, that we played okay. The midfield clearly bossed it. We were certainly as good as, until we got to the penalty area, certainly as good as we were against Middlesbrough. Against Charlton, it's just that none of them had their shooting boots on. So when you're saying, AD, about sort of being angry about the Charlton defeat, I'd also say that certainly listening to his comments post-Everton, you know, where he came away from the Arsenal game sort of quite pleased with the performance. He wasn't happy with the Everton performance. This bloke, Brian, he demands a lot, isn't he?
It is a bit of a classic manager's thing, though, to come out after a game in... Everybody expecting you to say it was perfect and to say, well, actually, this wasn't right. And to come out after a grim game and say, well, actually, this was a positive. So it is a little bit of a manager's tool in a way to keep things a little bit on an even keel. I just wondered that Charlton one, as disappointing as it was, could it almost have been a launch pad to what is to follow? We'll see how this carries on, because I was thinking to myself, winning at Arsenal in the Carabao Cup, that's wasting that because they've gone out.
Yeah.
But it did give them the Charlton game, and how important was that game when you see how rusty they were?
Absolutely.
In what then followed, and if it's going to motivate them through weeks and weeks as well, all the better. As much as it would have been nice to have won at Charlton and still had the motivation, there it does seem to be a silver lining that can be drawn from it.
We'll take that a stage further. That if, you know, if we had beaten Charlton, we'd now be away at Old Trafford. You know, this week, which is not necessarily the ideal preparation for playing Liverpool at home, given that, you know, Liverpool won't have a match during the week. So, you know, yes, you'd still rather try and win the competitions you're entering. And if you are going to progress, then you've got to beat the likes of Manchester United en route. That's fine.
Yeah.
However, you know, I think as a club that's still on its, as Neil said earlier, still on its journey, I still believe that the Premier League is still the priority, and that this is the season by which we get over the line that says, look, we are now an established club, so we can give the FA Cup or the League Cup a damn good thrashing if we want to.
I've said it before and I say it again, your job as a football club is to try and be successful as possible, and that's to be go as far as you possibly can in every cup competition, take them seriously, to finish as high up the league and try and get as much silverware into your trophy cabinet as you possibly can. That is your job as a football club.
Absolutely, but in this instance, holding to the resources that we've got as a football club.
For
so
sure.
Some things have to give.
For sure, but I mean, you know, I'm not saying that, you know, we went into the FA Cup, we're in the fourth division, but we were going to win it, but you know, you wanted to get as far as you possibly can. And, you know, I was watching the highlights the other day, and I was watching the Spurs v Portsmouth game, and I'm thinking, it wasn't that long ago that we went to Spurs as a League One side. Remember that Richard Carpenter goal?
That was brilliant. A great goal.
And we lost 2-1. But it was, you know, it wasn't that long ago that we were on that level. So the fact that we are now pushing upwards and our trajectory is so very much upwards, it's amazing. But one person,
just quickly, you say it wasn't that long ago, it was 18 years ago.
it was long ago.
Yeah.
That's it, yeah,
under Mark McGee, yeah.
It feels like yesterday.
Yeah, it was 18 years ago.
Oh, my God.
Sorry.
We were just talking about the Villa game as well when we lost 3-2. Yesterday as well.
That was 13 years ago.
That was under Gus, wasn't it?
January 2010, that was 13 years ago.
But what a journey that was. But one person who didn't make the journey to Middlesbrough was Leandro Trossard, Brian. I'm not quite sure I'm comfortable with the public criticism from the manager.
Yeah, I asked the question on, because the way I phrased it, this was before the Everton game, was about him having a different role and how was he having to adapt and maybe sacrifice a little bit, because the centre-forward or false centre-forward, however you put it, for Brighton, a lot of that job is bringing others into play and setting others up. And it was quite a short answer from De Zerbi, but it was along the lines of he's found it hard after the World Cup, as had one or two other players, but I'm not sure they found it quite as difficult. But yeah, I was surprised by that, what he said about him not... He does give you a little bit more deserving press conferences than some other managers. And I was surprised by that. And then obviously wasn't in the 20. And the press conference after the Middlesbrough game went on. And it's one of those where you want to talk about all the players who've done well and all the good performances, but you need to ask the question of where was Trossard? And he obviously said then... calf injury on Friday, but it was like as soon as I said Trossard, he starts his answer anyway, wasn't waiting for the rest of the question. So we don't know, do we? I mean, I've been told today that there's nothing going on at the moment, but also there seems to be some doubt as to how long he wants to be staying at Brighton for beyond his current commitment. So
has it been asked within the presses about bids coming in for anyone?
Well, obviously we had a chance to speak to Paul Barber about and he said nothing as yet had come in and they didn't want anything. At the moment it feels like Trossard is the player more likely to leave if somebody goes during this month, but it's obviously early days, and even some of the reports of Tottenham interest are stressing that nothing's come in, and if it does happen it will be later in the window. So we'll wait and see, don't we? And it's intriguing now they've got Tottenham coming up, Liverpool coming up, against whom he scored his hat-trick. But it feels like he, at the moment, Trossard is the one they could more likely afford to lose. But then equally what De Zerbi says, you know, Trossard at his best makes the team better. So, yeah. Sorry, that's sort of mixed messages, but we're sort of waiting for it all to happen in a way.
Well, I was saying last week, I mean, how much I've been enjoying him of late, and that he has been a little bit more consistent. But I mean, since the World Cup, and he didn't have a good World Cup either. I mean, I just wonder whether there was like a hangover from what was going on behind the scenes in Qatar. But I mean, it's only speculation.
But like I say, this is,
so we can't really.
This is just form, isn't it? I mean, if we're going to say since the World Cup, we're talking about mid-November, and every single player that's ever pulled on their boots has a slump in form, has a dip in form. Now, obviously, the games weren't coming as thick and fast in the World Cup as they would have been in the league and the cup. And like I say, he was part of, you know, he was a bit part player in a bit part team. You know, and as much as, you know, Martinez has now got the Portugal gig, and someone said, you know, did you fail at Belgium? And he said, well, we were number one for a long time. I thought, well, yeah, great, but you didn't win any trophies. I don't think you even got to a final. And even we did that. Even England have done that in your time. So, you know, there's a wasted opportunity that's happened. And one wonders the extent to which it plays on various players' minds that they come back from the World Cup. Let's put it this way. I don't think it's unreasonable to say that of all those players that actually played in the World Cup that were Brighton players, and I have to take Sanchez out of this because he didn't play, Trossard was, let's say, the least effective. He was the least effective in a pretty ineffective team. I hope it hasn't affected him, but, you know, does he have other things on his mind? Is he sort of thinking that a move that, should it ever come to fruition, is now or never?
Yeah, possibly. But the flip side of that, from De Zerbi's point of view, is that he thinks that Trossard could be really, really good. Because he was even saying after his hat-trick against Liverpool, after he scored at Man City and had a very good game, that he can do more, he can be better than this. So is he thinking he's somebody? Because he's not talking about form here. The sort of message coming across was about effort. And you can be off form but still be given 100% effort and running around a lot. So is he thinking, it's almost like he thinks he's got a very good player here who and it's worth whatever way he can do to get the absolute best out of him. Yeah. Because he's been, when you look back, he's praised him and he said, yeah, we're better when he's playing. But he's also been quite harsh in a way when he was playing well and scoring. If you remember, Frostow scored the first five goals that Brighton scored under De Zerbi. And even then he was saying he can do more. So maybe he thinks that's because there is something really worth working with there.
Maybe he's the kind of manager that understands the notion of carrot or stick, isn't he?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
He said the same about Solly, didn't he? So, and it was like, you know, it was the classic thing that, was it Gus Poyer was saying about Adam Elad? And it's like, all of a sudden, Adam Elad became one of the best players in the world.
But he's even made comments about McAllister needing to touch the ball 100 times in the game. And he's going, what? And of course, now he does that. It's just a case of, it's not 100 touches. That's not what it's about. It's just making sure he's on the ball as much as possible, pulling the strings. It just so happens that you know, getting 100 touches, you know, is the way that it's going to be achieved. So make sure the fact that they actually then have that kind of quantifiable tactic is a little bit bizarre, and I hope it doesn't play on their mind, you know, compared to the rest of what they do. But seeing as that the majority of players have improved over the past few weeks, whatever it is, it seems to be working.
Okay, Brian, another player who didn't make the journey up north was Lewis Dunk, and his place was taken by Jean-Paul Van Heck. Oh, I thought he had a magnificent game.
Yeah, very good. And obviously he had that very good season at Blackburn in the Championship, and he was one of the names mentioned by De Zerbi, who wasn't asked about him, who he picked out as playing pretty well. There was one header I think he went for and missed out on when Middlesbrough went through and had that chance at 1-1.
Yeah.
But I think he was pleased with him and Levi Colwill, and obviously Webster now back, which was a little bit ahead of schedule, a little bit unexpected. So obviously Dunk comes back in for Van Heck, but they have got that a little bit more strength at the back as well. And Colwill's done pretty well. I'm sure he's learned a lot as well.
There was a side of me that thought that, you know, especially as Colwill arrived at the time of the Cucurella nonsense and Chelsea's, you know, Chelsea's standing amongst a lot of Brighton fans was low in the first place. And there was a side of you, if you really wanted to indulge in cynicism, you think, well, why should we bother helping Chelsea, you know, with one of their players? He's on loan to us. Yes, he's a talent. He did well at Huddersfield, et cetera, et cetera. And you don't want him to do well on account of the fact that just means you're handing back a superior product to Chelsea at the end of the season. And why the hell should we do that? And of course, you know, then that's along the lines of, well, Chelsea saying they want to keep him at the end of the season. Brighton may or may not put a bid in for him. Who knows? But actually, that's me just being a little bit of an arse, I think. Colwill is actually a pretty decent player, isn't he?
Well, I wish he would stop standing on the ball.
Like, apart from that, you're right.
But isn't that the whole plan? It's just to wait and wait and wait for somebody to press him and open something, some other opportunity up. So I think that's, I think if he doesn't do that, he won't be in the team.
I do get that, but it's certainly backfired against Arsenal because he stood on the ball and they just didn't fall for it. And for me, it just slowed everything down. Second half, he didn't do it anything like as much and we were just going through the gears. So it's an interesting tactic and you can see exactly what it is. I mean, it's quite overt as if to say, he might as well just sort of stick his arms up and say, come on then, do you want some?
Yeah.
But
I mean, it was funny when Kasper Ankergren was doing it. I'm not so sure I'm finding it funny. Quite so amusing with it, but I mean, it is an interesting conundrum going into this weekend, Brian. With Adam back fit again, I mean, Lewis will be obviously straight back in the team. Van Heck will probably go back onto the bench, but I mean, would you say Colwill still starts? He's got the shirt, and Webster's still finding his way back.
I think so. Webster only played like about 10 minutes or something, and Colwill went off because he had cramps. So I think so. I think it's still at right back. You think Veltman comes back in for Lamptey, and then it's really interesting. I remember McAllister was on the bench. You think he comes back in to start. Lallana is fit and playing well. Does McAllister come in alongside Caicedo as that double pivot, or does he go further forward? I think the wide two are pretty much set in stone with March and Mitoma. Who starts up front? And then does Trossard play? And where does he fit in? So there's a few. It's going to be quite interesting, but there's a few set in stone. Especially now McAllister, I think, has to start.
Is Welbeck ready or not?
We'll maybe find out more on Friday, but he can't be far off because they were talking about him playing sort of half a game. It didn't quite work out like that. But what's Ferguson done for him not to start. I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk about McAllister, because I mean I've got his name written down four times in a row in my notes here, which was, I mean he came on, it was a 45-minute cameo, and he nearly went home with the match ball, and it was just, it's just
again
I can't say I can't eulogize about Alexis enough, and I love him, but it's and you know, and he's like, he's, you know, you're seeing certain rumors about other players, but he's certainly very committed to the cause and wants to be at Brighton, and that's brilliant.
Yeah, and he was saying that he did a press thing in a, looked like a sports center or something, or a town hall in his hometown. And he was saying that in Argentina, because of the whole agenda there, or the whole sort of mood of the coverage was, right, when you're going to go to a big club we've heard of. And he was saying, even then, I think I reported at the time, I'm in no rush to leave. Brighton have been so good for me, and that they know how I feel about them, and all this sort of thing. So, I don't see... I mean, before, a colleague from Merseyside was talking about these players staying and seeing it through to get into... hopefully say get Brighton into Europe, which is fair enough and as far as it goes. But then what happens if they get into Europe and then they leave, these players? So you'd like it to be even further along. I don't know how that will work, and if that's wishful thinking, if Brighton were to get into a Europa League, does that help them stay for longer? I'm really, really not sure. But yeah, McAllister, that got the first goal, I must admit, sitting it up in the almost the back row, I didn't quite register what he'd done to turn that ball into the net. It looked like a very deft flick, but it was only then seeing the replay you see how good it was. And free kick, obviously one free kick not far away, and the other, as it turned out, just flicked the post. So, but getting a long way forward. By the way, Adam Lallana, the easiest finish of the lot, but good to see him so far forward as well. It was one of those where the hard bit was getting there. And what was he when he scored his goal, I'm talking about, and he was like 6 inches out when he scored. But
yeah, and Ferguson was right next to him, and Ferguson wasn't very happy.
Yeah, I thought the ball had gone past Ferguson, either, but... actually. I don't know if he was getting
I think,
to
no,
it.
I think Ferguson was leaving it because he thought like he was going to let Matoma have the goal.
Yeah.
It was
unreal sitting there. You think there was almost like a silence, like what's just happened? That's got to be disallowed. But obviously, there was nothing wrong with it whatsoever. It's just such a... almost like to have two players ready to tap into an empty net is quite rare.
But I mean, we've seen Solly March getting amongst the goals finally, but he really should have added to his tally on Saturday. But fortunately, Pascal was there to sweep home into the empty net. And that is all we got time for this week. So thank you so much to Brian Owen. Thank you to Neil Atkinson. Thank you to Alan Wares. I've been Ailey Packham. This has been the Albion Raw on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast and in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you all again next week. Bye.
star.